Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
So, we're going to start a new study that is entirely self-serving, like I said. Or maybe it is other serving through me. Maybe that's how it works. But I want to have us spend a few weeks looking at Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail. And the self-serving part of this is that I'm going to be teaching a synod school class on the letter from Birmingham jail, and I'll talk about why I'm teaching that class at this particular moment. And so really I'm just kind of workshopping not even like my class plans, but I'm making sure that I'm familiar enough with the letter to sort of shape the way that that needs to be taught at synod school. So synod school will have some boring details that you don't have to do because of the things that I expect synod school people to be interested in. And that means you get to actually spend more time with the letter itself. So how about that? So here's the reason that I want to study the letter from Birmingham jail, or particularly the reason I said somebody's got to study this at synod school. And the reason is that at General Assembly last summer, the General Assembly took action to begin studying the letter from Birmingham jail with an eye toward potentially including it in the Book of Confessions. This took place on June 21st, 2018, and the General Assembly voted about two to one to initiate the process toward amending the Book of Confessions to potentially include the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. King wrote the letter, dated April 16th, 1963, so we're coming up on its 56th anniversary, while jailed in Birmingham, Alabama, for leading a protest march without a permit. He wrote the letter, now considered a classic of world literature, on the margins of newspapers and the backs of legal papers, and had his lawyers smuggle it out of the jail. In it, he defended the philosophy of nonviolent demonstration in the face of injustice, and argued that citizens have, quote, not only a legal but a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. The letter was written as a response to 8 white clergymen who had denounced King as a troublemaker and an outsider. So, I want to... I wrote to the Synod School Committee when it was time to submit class proposals, and I said, someone has to teach this class. If we have just acted to begin studying the letter from Birmingham jail toward including it in the Book of Confessions, what better place than Synod School? And I also said, I don't feel remotely qualified to be the one teaching this. Tell that to the Synod School Committee. So here I am. I'll be teaching this at Synod School.
Oh, no.
With that, you've just volunteered.
Yeah.
Well, I did say I would do it if absolutely no one else could, but somebody else ought to do it, because somebody else is better qualified, better positioned to teach this, partly because I am so very much the audience of the letter from Birmingham jail. I'm so very much the one addressed by Dr. King in this letter. So I'll just touch really briefly on what it means to include something in the Book of Confessions for those of you whose elder training is a little while in the past. So you know we've got a whole book full of confessional statements dating all the way from the Nicene Creed in the 4th century all the way up to a brief statement of faith in, like, 1991. And we have collected these from various places in the strain of Christian history that has produced the Presbyterians. And we've collected these and lifted them up as sort of faithful responses in their moment to the historical setting that they find themselves in, that say something enduring about what Christian faith is about. And so there's a process, because we're Presbyterians, we always have a process for it, for adding a document to the Book of Confessions. And if we add a document to the Book of Confessions, we say that this document faithfully tells us what Scripture would have us believe and do. So that's kind of the guiding question behind the Synod School layer of the study, is what would it mean for us to include this document as a confession in our Book of Confessions? It also, speaking to Synod School, the theme for Synod School this year is creating civil community. Creating civil community. And so I think you'll find, if you just sort of hold that question in your mind, what does it mean to be civil community? I think this letter has some really interesting things to say to the question of what is civil community and how would we go about creating that. There is also, I think, a lot of contemporary relevance to the letter from Birmingham Jail. And so I'm going to read to you, this is a Twitter thread, so series of short posts that are all strung together by a commentator named Andre Henry. He posted this on Martin Luther King Jr. Day this year. And he is riffing on a moment in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 23 when Jesus stands up and pronounces woes. So he's pronouncing, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites." So Andre Henry takes that denunciation and brings it forward to today, interspersed with iconic pictures from the last day of Martin Luther King's life. So he says, "Woe to you, you hypocrites! You establish national holidays for the prophets and recite the speeches of the righteous. And you say, if we had lived during the civil rights movement, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourselves that you are the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. Go ahead then and complete what your ancestors started. You snakes, you brood of vipers, how will you escape being condemned to hell? Therefore I am sending you more freedom fighters. Some of them you will kill and revile, others you will send to prison and exile. And so upon you will come all the righteous blood that has been shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whom you murdered at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. America, America, you who kill the prophets and lynch those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together, as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate, for I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" A play on Matthew chapter 23, verses 30 through 39. And if you go back and read that, that is exactly what Jesus said, with the historical references updated from the first century to the 21st century. And I recognize myself in that challenge. And I recognize myself in Dr. King's disappointment with white moderates. That's who he is going to address in this letter from Birmingham Jail, white moderates. Which is me and me. And so I really recognize myself in what he's going to be saying to us in this letter. So Birmingham was a long time ago, although not that long ago, right? So here is a synopsis of the sort of context of the writing of the letter from Birmingham Jail. Again, Dr. King wrote the letter. It was sort of formally completed on April 16th, 1963. The Birmingham campaign was organized in early 1963 by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to bring attention to the integration efforts of African Americans in Birmingham, Alabama. Led by Martin Luther King Jr., James Bevel, Fred Shuttlesworth, and others, the campaign of nonviolent direct action culminated in widely publicized confrontations between young black students and white civic authorities, and eventually led to the municipal government to change the city's discrimination laws. In the early 1960s, Birmingham was one of the most racially divided cities in the United States, both as enforced by law and culturally. Black citizens faced legal and economic disparities and violent retribution when they attempted to draw attention to their problems. Martin Luther King Jr. called it the most segregated city in the country. Protests in Birmingham began with a boycott led by Shuttlesworth, meant to pressure business leaders to open employment to people of all races and end segregation in public facilities, restaurants, schools, and stores. When local business and governmental leaders resisted the boycott, SCLC, that's the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, agreed to assist. Organizer Wyatt T. Walker joined Birmingham activist Shuttlesworth and began what they called Project C, that's C for confrontation, a series of sit-ins and marches intended to provoke mass arrests. When the campaign ran low on adult volunteers, James Bevel, SCLC's director of direct action, thought of the idea of having students become the main demonstrators in the Birmingham campaign. He then trained and directed high school, college, and elementary school students in nonviolence and asked them to participate in the demonstrations by taking a peaceful walk, 50 at a time, from the 16th Street Baptist Church to City Hall in order to talk to the mayor about segregation. This resulted in over 1,000 arrests, and as the jails and holding areas filled with arrested students, the Birmingham Police Department, led by Eugene Bull Connor, used high-pressure water hoses and police attack dogs on the children and adult bystanders. Not all of the bystanders were peaceful, despite the avowed intentions of SCLC to hold a completely nonviolent walk, but the students held to the nonviolent premise. King and the SCLC drew both criticism and praise for allowing children to participate and put themselves in harm's way. The Birmingham campaign was a model of nonviolent direct action protest and, through the media, drew the world's attention to racial segregation in the South. It burnished King's reputation, ousted Connor from his job, forced desegregation in Birmingham, and directly paved the way for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibited racial discrimination in hiring practices and public services throughout the United States. The involvement of the students in this Project C, in these nonviolent marches, that involvement actually happened after Dr. King was arrested. He was arrested on April 12, 1963, which was Good Friday. And he was kept in solitary confinement for several days without confidential access to his attorneys, which is, of course, one of those rights provided by the Constitution, right? On the day he was arrested, the newspaper was printed containing a call for unity, a statement by 8 white Alabama clergymen against King and his methods. An ally smuggled that newspaper in to King that while he was in the jail. And the letter provoked King, and he began to write a response right on the margins of the newspaper itself. King wrote later, "Begun on the margins of the newspaper in which the statement appeared while I was in jail, the letter was continued on scraps of writing paper supplied by a friendly black trustee and concluded on a pad my attorneys were eventually permitted to leave me." So the letter from Birmingham Jail is a response to another letter, and I'm going to give you both letters to look at, because the letter from Birmingham Jail is the sort of classic of the civil rights era. But this this letter that it is a response to is another thing that sort of cuts me deep, because I can certainly hear my own voice in it. So I'm going to give you both of those to read for next time. That's where I told you I wouldn't ask you to do homework, but here, if you want to keep up, there's a little bit of homework. But first, just questions about kind of the context in Birmingham. That Wikipedia article was not as fleshed out as it might otherwise have been. But what do you know about that context that you feel is relevant to our conversation, or what do you feel you don't know that we should make sure we get answered?
We up north aren't completely innocent.
Right. So there's a.
I was born and raised in Waterloo, which has the largest percentage of blacks of any city in Iowa, and they were discriminated against for a long time.
So this is maybe a piece of the conversation about, especially on the sort of on the Presbyterian side, do we include this in our Book of Confessions, and what does it say to us to sort of give it that status? What does it say to us? And you know, we are living in the North, and we are also more than 91% white, which is the denomination's level of segregation. So as a white congregation in the upper Midwest, I think it's important to hear us in this. And there's a whole sort of untold history of segregation in the North. Yeah. Which Dr. King knew about at the time. Anything else you feel like you need to know or need to make sure is clear to our context here?
Well, one thing that strikes me is that how little progress was made 100 years after the Civil War was fought.
Yeah.
And why, I mean, a lot of politicians had died in that period, you know, in terms of, you know, that's one way we solve some of these Bull Connors, you know, the Grim Reaper, eventually will get him too. But to think there was so little progress in 100 years, it was just kind of like we had this big Civil War, and then after it was finished, we didn't follow up with what it was supposed to accomplish, be it federal level, state level, city level, government.
Right, and the policies that that the Southern civil rights movement was specifically working to address often were policies that came into being a couple of decades after the Civil War. So there was this period of Reconstruction after the Civil War,
and when the federal troops were pulled out.
Right, so there was
Reconstruction.
Yeah.
Well, how much do we know the Civil War was about blacks, and how much of it was that you cannot withdraw from the Union?
I'm not sure you can separate those questions in the case of the Civil War.
It depends upon the person involved.
But Kent's right that there was a continued federal occupation of the former Confederate states after the Civil War that obviously needed to end after some point anyway, but as that as sort of the occupation ended,
there was an agreement in there that came back out, and I can't remember what the agreement was.
Yeah, that's a piece of the history that I'm not as up on.
Then the Jim Crow laws started taking effect.
Right. So there was a period of time when the sort of the legal framework in the South was a federally imposed Reconstruction, and Reconstruction ended. And so there was this Reconstruction era, and then there was the Jim Crow era, and the segregation laws were really purpose built in order to stop and reverse any progress that had been made by the Civil War, other than that, okay, nominally African Americans were free. Were they free to anything? No. So there was a lot of work that went into making sure that the Civil War didn't take. And you're right, then it was 100 years on that Dr. King is working to finally finish I say Dr. King like he was the only one, that the SCLC and SNCC and the other organizations, the NAACP, are working together and often working across purposes, as is often the case in a period of change like that, working to actually do some of the work of the Civil War. So now, we're not 100 years on from Birmingham, but we're 56 years on from Birmingham. How are you doing?
Now it's just more subtle.
Yeah.
I think there's there's still racism, and I think you can see it in the with the recent thing on the Muslims, and I don't mean New Zealand. I mean the young woman, the congresswoman from Minnesota.
Oh yeah.
When they're starting to carry on about, well, now that's an anti-Semitic statement, as opposed to the fact that I don't think it's so much anti-Semitic as it was the fact that that's something that she and Muslims are living with as well, and they finally got them around to saying it should be against all hate, and there were still people that didn't think that was a good idea.
Yeah,
it's just kind of gone, to me, it's kind of gone under. You can kind of say, well, yeah, we're all, things are getting better. If you're white, it's okay to say things are getting better. But
right.
I don't know that it would be if you ask the black people or the others.
Yeah, so there's this national myth of forward progress, that all our progress is forward, right? And there is, especially in, I'm just starting another layer of reading toward the Synod School class, so you'll hear me bouncing this off as I go through this conversation with you. There's a way that we tell the history of the Civil Rights Movement, and before that, the way we tell the history of the Civil War, that makes it sound like we would have been on the correct side. That's what strikes me so clearly about Andre Henry's rewriting of Jesus, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." And it's what strikes me about the letter from Birmingham Jail too. That I like to think that I would be on the right side, and I have to say that I know I wouldn't, because I have the opportunity to be on the right side right now, and even when I know where I should be, I drag my feet getting there. But we imagine, the way we tell the history, you know, we tell the history of, oh, Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, they're our heroes, right? Dr. King's approval rating the day he was shot was like 24% nationally. We did not like him. We did not like him. We may have liked a little bit of what he was standing for, but here I am quoting the eight clergymen who wrote the letter that prompted the letter. We agree with what he's trying to do, we just don't like how he's doing it. We don't like his methods, right? And we continue to say that. As white moderates, we continue to say that. So there's this sort of this great man model of history that allows us to sort of travel along in his wake, which, again, as Vera pointed out, even looking all the way back to the Civil War, it's not like the North was entirely on the right side of the Civil War either. The racism that was present all throughout the North, the racism that was in the White House, in the person of the one who wrote the Emancipation Proclamation, it's not so clean, and so our history is not so tidy. Ken,
well, you talk about I sometimes wonder if we ever really have the right approach to some of this, in the sense that Johnson's Great Society pumped a lot of money into poverty programs, mm-hmm. and yet our poverty hasn't really changed a lot. And I look at myself, I've always wondered if we, you know, they talked about desegregation of schools and then all the white suburbs popped up, because it's great as long as it's not you
right.
that's being affected. You know, as a population, yeah, I can go with it, but if it's my kid being dropped into a 60% black school, I'll probably think about moving if I could.
Right.
Because I value education, and I sometimes wonder if we took the right approach just to, I believe strongly in education, and I don't know if we should have focused so much on desegregation as we should have just quality of education with the schools. And from what I read, Jerry can jump in here because he's the expert on this, but what I've read is, at some point, you have to give the individual, the young student, and I emphasize young, because they talk about the young student needs to feel safe, so they need a safe home where they can go to from school or whatever. And then they need an environment where they feel that they can perform. And they talk about in the book, one of the books I read, that if you haven't achieved that by a certain age, even if you can get this person up to intellectual level on a 10th grade reading, for example, the cultural emphasis they've learned at that point is still difficult to break because they want to be accepted in their culture. Does that make sense? And are you following what I'm saying?
I think so, yeah.
If you don't capture him at age 1 through 7, you've lost him somewhat because of the cultural things and not just the educational things that you may get up to speed on, because they want to feel a part of their peers.
So I cringe a little bit at words like culture in the sense of explaining differential, especially racial outcomes, because it's at least way too easy to turn that into, oh, people of color just can't learn as well.
No, I didn't say that.
Do you hear how close you are to saying?
Right. The thing is, we segregated them for so long. Like I say, percentage-wise, so, Waterloo is the worst in the whole state of Iowa. By the time I got into high school, we had 3 blacks.
Right. Now segregation is part of what makes the idea of separate but better still just separate but equal, right?
To some degree, I probably have said that. I'm comfortable with that either.
You know, so what I heard you say was, maybe the emphasis shouldn't have been on integrating the schools, but rather improving all the schools.
Yeah.
As long as you fund schools with property taxes and either segregate or redline, which is just segregation without a law, or with a law, but it's a zoning code. It's not a legal. You can't live here. It's just that you're not going to get a chance to, right? Mm-hmm. As long as you fund schools with property taxes and redline, both of those things happened throughout the 20th century. Continue to happen in their own ways with, as I mean, you described white flight as the, you know, I want it to happen, but I don't want it to happen to my kid, right?
Right.
As long as you do that, you will always end up with unequal separate schools. As long as you tie property values to race and school capacity, school quality to property values, you will always end up with separate but unequal schools.
I think you can see that now.
Right. Now, that doesn't mean you can't do a lot of good early childhood interventions, make sure that you've got somebody reading as well as they can possibly read. But Andre Henry has a great education. I actually don't know his credentials, but he's put together. It's not bad. But the hill that he had to climb compared to the hill that I had to climb, it's a totally different game. Right? But that is a piece of where we still find ourselves. We still find ourselves here in the metro, knowing very well which schools are which. And if we're honest with ourselves, we know why some of those schools are which. Now, it's more subtle these days and more subtle in the North. I've heard people of color say, you know, I would rather be in the South where at least I know which kind of racist that person's going to be. But in the North, everybody's too polite and I can't keep them figured out. Right? Now, that's one way of looking at it. There are other ways of looking at it, obviously. But there's a way that we're just not seeing as clearly what has always been there.
You're generally, I would say that you're correct in terms of property values and so forth, except after 1970 or so forth, the laws related to school funding changed, mm-hmm. so that a local board of education has no control over the amount of money that they raise.
Okay.
I mean, it's a state formula type of thing,
mm-hmm.
and that was all based on the problems with disparities within states, which would mean that a place like Council Bluffs would always get less money than other places, mm-hmm. because of the property value, and the whole equalization process is such that you don't, just because you're a West Des Moines doesn't mean that you've got more money,
mm-hmm.
per kid than somebody else.
That's good. Thank you for that. Yeah. For that perspective.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't solve a lot of the other, you know, all the issues.
Right.
But there's been efforts to correct that.
Right. So the schools under a per pupil funding formula, the schools are able to become more equal.
Yeah.
And then the only question is, yeah, then what's the, you know, what's sort of the infrastructure, social and physical, around the school.
Another issue that affected urban areas when all the freeways went through,
mm-hmm.
where did they put them? Right through the poor areas, and so what was a community no longer is a community, and it affects your property values and who wants to live in certain places, so.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of white flight, yeah. at that point. I mean, Cottage Grove encountered that. I remember, I mean, I was, in the 50s, it was wealthy
church. There was a lot of wealthy people, but as the freeway started coming in, people, blacks were moving into the area, and white flight. I mean, the wealthy in the church weren't going to live in a black community, so they moved west.
Right.
And it really changed. What was left was the poorer people who couldn't afford to move out of the area. But it really, I mean, that the freeway just made a big difference. Like when my brother was at Calumet, there was only one black person in the school, and that was in the early 60s.
Depends on family. I was working on the east side for a while when I was here, and I can vividly remember one morning I was there early, and I was watching this kid go to school. I don't know what school he's in. He's on his bike, he had his books, and he was smoking a cigarette. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I have a feeling this guy was going to be difficult to teach. And if my dad had ever caught me doing that, he probably would have paid a price, and he was a heavy smoker. But how do you compensate for lack of family support for some of this?
Right, and what are the causes of the lack of family support? You know, what are the factors that are
lack
correlated?
Of education would be one.
Right, education, opportunity. So there's there's a lot that's sort of going on alongside this. I'm reminded of something that Martin Luther King also said. He said this better than I would, obviously, but he shifted his focus sort of after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. He knew his work wasn't done, and so he had shifted his focus, or continued his focus. He would say very clearly, this was not a change away from racial inequality, but this was a continued work on the inequality that's always been there. But he shifted a lot of his focus from specifically addressing racist legislation, because that had changed a great deal, and focused more explicitly on poverty. And he said there was a time that he was in jail, and he said, I always try to take the opportunity to preach to the people who are running the jail. And so he was talking to a white jailer and said, okay, tell me about your situation, your family, and whatever. And he said, now here's the thing. You ought to be on my side in this, because you are as poor as the poor black people you're keeping down. And if you could both realize that you had common cause against the forces of wealth and privilege that are keeping you down in your place, then we'd actually be a lot farther ahead. So he said the white sanitation worker and the black sanitation worker, remember he was in Memphis specifically to work with sanitation workers who were going on strike, said the black sanitation worker and the white sanitation worker are on the same team here, and the idea that white people are this team and black people are that team is a way of keeping that team keeping the actual team of poor people from gaining any traction. I was reminded of that as you were describing, Kent, sort of the structural and cultural, but sort of the cultural forces that are poverty. The cultural effects of poverty in terms of the ability to keep a family structure together. The changes in family structure are not a white people of color thing. The changes in family structure are an economic class thing. And economic class is correlated with race, but it's also masked by the idea of race. And so as we, as we sort of work with the way that these things are all connected to each other, this gets a lot more complicated. And as we deal with what it means to be well-meaning white people, which I will assume we are all well-meaning.
No,
pretty sure we are all racialized as white.
Right.
I will say, for us as well-meaning white people, it's important for us to keep in mind sort of where we stand in this.
I think one comment. I think some of it, we have to look at, if you're looking at present day, a whole lot of it is political, and they have found the way to make everybody feel threatened. In that, if they give anybody that's got, they'll work their way up, and you're going to be threatened, your status is going to be changed, and you are no longer going to be able to do the things you are. For example, the invasion that's coming from over the border, everybody's wanting to come and take our jobs. Everybody's wanting to come and change the whole status of the country. So instead of just making it black right now, I think they're making it white, particularly white and white nationalism against anybody that's different. So it's they're using a fear thing.
So yeah, the way that particularly racial lines, but lots of other kinds of lines are drawn, is typically a way of putting a face on some other sort of disruptive threat, or creating a disruptive threat that may not even have been there in the first place. So many of us are wearing green today, right? The ways that Catholic Irish immigrants were stigmatized, marginalized, and physically attacked are very much analogous to the ways that African Americans were stigmatized, marginalized, and attacked. Which is not to put those things on a level with each other. Levels are like the wrong word here. But who would have been most threatened by an influx of working class, and they're not Protestant, that's a problem, right? But who would have been most threatened by an influx of a working class labor pool? The Germans, English and German former immigrants whose jobs were also being, at the same time, this is the early 20th century, right, whose jobs were being mechanized out from under them, and whose farm economy was already in trouble, right? The farm economy has been in trouble since before the Dust Bowl. There's this other economic thing that gets put on, in that case, the Irish, just as easily put on African Americans, just as easily today put on other immigrants and refugees of color who don't speak the language, who had a grandparent who didn't speak the language, right? Lots of us had grandparents, or at least great-grandparents. I had a great-grandmother who, I think she spoke English, but she never quit speaking German, that's for sure. And so, this is not that long ago, right? This is not that long ago that we were the people we are now scared of. I numbered my paragraphs. You're welcome to, if you like, the letter from Birmingham Jail. It is a little lengthy. Dr. King apologizes for that during the letter. You also have, I don't need to introduce him, but you also have the public statement by 8 Alabama clergymen that ran in the paper in Birmingham on the day that Dr. King went to be arrested. These clergymen are Catholic, Episcopalian, Methodist, Presbyterian, Baptist, Methodist, Jewish. I think that's everybody. This you know, these are the upstanding leaders of the white church in Birmingham saying, you know, we understand what you're doing, but we disapprove of how you're doing it. And that really got Dr. King's nose out of joint, so he wrote a classic of Western literature. So I invite you to read those for next time. Just kind of chew on them. Then we're gonna spend some time just kind of walking through the Dr. King's letter. You only just need to know what the clergy letter says so that you can recognize that it sounds like me. But we're going to walk through some specific passages from the letter and have some discussion questions and conversation about that starting next week. So, thank you all.
There were no Catholics that were involved in that.
In the clergy letter?
In the clergy letter.
Actually, there were. Yeah, and Joseph Durick for sure is. I think C.C.J. Carpenter.
Oh, Diocese of Mobile.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think they are both Catholic, but I'm not certain about that. One of them might be. Episcopalian.
That's
Catholic.
Why I was wondering
yeah.
when it said.
But
just
yes, there's. I could find out for sure the name of the
Catholic. I just wondered
Catholic,
if they were
yes.
left out, considering there was a lot of. You know,
right.
There's discrimination against Catholics.
Right. Yeah.
Too, so.
Right. But yeah, and you notice that's how discrimination works, right? Like, you know, we will discriminate against them, but we will discriminate against her, right? So she's in our group sometimes, but not all the time, right? So, so that's part of the way that in-group out-group structuring tends to work. So, but yes, so there was a Catholic clergy person, I think possibly two, involved in the writing of this.
And note the history books, I mean, when I was in school, didn't talk much about the African-American fight.
Right, yeah.
It wasn't written into the books.
Right, yeah. And
it was just the Civil War and the brought and made
right.
free.
The Civil War and everything's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about Reconstruction.
Right, yeah.
There was a lot of discrimination right. after the Civil War.
Right, so, and by the time I was in school, which was a couple years after Sue was in school. By the time I was in school, there was the Civil War and Reconstruction and Jim Crow, but Jim Crow, but that was in the South. And then the Civil Rights Movement, and everything's fine. Right? That was the history I learned. The history my kids are learning is better than that. It's not going to be complete yet, but it's better than the history I learned, which is better than the history Sue learned. And it's also a lot harder to learn, right? It's a lot harder to learn the history that I learned than the history of... Well, the Civil War happened, and then everything was fine.
Well, right? I was always taught, too, that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves. He was this great man because he freed the slaves, and then you find out later that he didn't care whether we freed the slaves. He just wanted the Union to stay together. Either everybody had slavery or nobody, but, you know.
Right. Which doesn't mean he wasn't on the right side, right? But it does mean that, yeah, he was a lot more complicated than we would like to think.
But he did do a deal that got the amendment placed to solidify that position.
Right.
It was a technical issue whether it could have lasted because it was a presidential proclamation.
Right, yeah.
Not a constitutional. It wasn't voted on.
Right. So yeah, it's...
It gets to be complicated.
It is super complicated. I think that's one of the things that we will end up learning, is that this history is really complicated and that we are really complicated. So keep finding yourself in this history. So, thanks.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.